This week, millions of Americans turned their hopefully entirely protected eyes skyward to observe the eclipse, and social media filled with blurry images of the event, stories about when the total eclipse last passed this way, and of veteran reporters getting endearingly misty at the sight of totality, and tons of other stories about that proverbial final frontier, space. Indeed, once merely the backdrop of moonlight and twinkly stars, or something in a galaxy far, far away, space is still a source of awe and wonder for even the cynical, especially now as we begin to factor in tech giants like Amazon flirting with the technology of sending cargo to future space settlements, big players in the tech space like Elon Musk of SpaceX, and others taking steps to privatize space travel. The future, as it is often said, is now. Although we learn more and more about space every day, and events like this week's eclipse help us to learn even more still. Indeed, it's a scientific, logical, and exact place and academic area of study, yet it also has the power to inspire a sense of awe, to defy all that logic, even by those in the field itself. Tonight on the Saturday Night Special, we are going to talk about space, the things we've hypothesized as we've gazed upon the night sky for centuries, all the way to how we're thinking about it and venturing into it now. We'll look at those players in the tech space and the ethical, historical, and scientific issues their work raises. We'll learn a little about what we learned from scientists' work during this week's eclipse. We'll take a look at the study of space and where we're looking next. And we'll look back at the great space race and look at who made history and why. As ever, we'll be joined by experts to help us talk through this topic that is perhaps literally infinite. I'm Amy Guth, and that's all coming up tonight on the Saturday Night Special. I couldn't resist playing a little of that theme song for tonight's show, which is all about space. What else are we going to talk about on the heels of the big eclipse? That even though we were not in the path of totality right here in Chicago, we still had about 87% coverage, which was still pretty darn cool. So we are going to talk all about space tonight, from how we thought about the night sky hundreds of years ago to our first ventures into the beyond to issues that are now being raised very carefully and thoughtfully by tech companies that are trying to get out ahead of this idea of privatized space travel. We will be joined by author and tech writer Alex Salkever, by head of astronomy education at Adler Planetarium, Michelle Nichols, who you might remember because we talked to her earlier in the summer because she was helping us get ready for the eclipse and telling us everything we needed to know. She was down in Carbondale for the event, and she's going to give us an update about all of that. And we're going to talk with Dr. John Turris, who is a professor of political science, and we're going to talk about what is so interesting about how the space race and the civil rights movement were happening at the same time and how they played into one another just a bit. So we're going to be talking about that. And as ever, we have so much to do and so many smart people coming onto the show to help us think through this topic. So I cannot guarantee we're going to have tons of space for calls, but I do want to make time for some of the calls. So 312-981-7200. I would love to hear from you, especially around privatized space travel, because that is going to be a thing we're going to be able to decide whether or not we can do and want to do soon. So I'd love to hear from you about that, if you would be willing to go to space if you had the funding to do so. So give us a call, 312-981-7200. Esteemed producer Tom Hush will be the very friendly voice on the other end of the line. Or you can find me on Twitter. I'm at Amy Guth, G-U-T-H, and you can help me geek out on space there and ask questions of our experts and all of that good stuff. So we will be right back to get tonight's show all about space underway here on 720 WGN. I had to pull that one out of the archives. I may or may not have that on vinyl in my home. It is a disco remix from right after, I mean months after Star Wars came out. Disco had to get its claws into it.
Disco is the music of the future, if you ask me.
Intergalactic Funk, and it is a fine album cover with people in spacesuits doing the bump. It's a good time right there. Well, as that might suggest, tonight's program is all about space. There's so much to talk about. We're all looking up at the sky this week because of the eclipse, and suddenly there's a lot of stuff about space, and particularly in the business sector as we're looking at the privatization of space travel, and as we're looking at companies like Amazon and SpaceX doing work in that area. The Amazon part is really fascinating to me, the idea that Amazon and Jeff Bezos are working on the ability to send cargo into space just to get out ahead of, once humans have settlements there, we're going to need stuff. And so that's, I'm sure it won't be the full arsenal of things available on Amazon, as we were talking about earlier today with the Whole Foods merger, but...
I mean, how else am I going to get my kale delivered to...
am I going to get kale on Mars?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't think anything grows there yet.
Give it time. Well, I think it raises some interesting questions. Would you, Tom, if you had the funds to do so, because we don't exactly know what those tickets are going to look like yet, or if you're going to have like credit card miles you can use or what?
Space miles.
If you had the means to do so, would you travel to space?
That's a tough one, because I guess every time I see a news story about the tests that they're doing, one goes well, one doesn't go so well. Right. I just don't want to be on the ship that doesn't go so well. But I think having the opportunity, if, say, everything were to hypothetically go perfect, I would get to Mars on time and nothing bad would happen, I'd definitely go to space.
Sure.
Like, why not? You know, if you have the ability, if you have the willingness of spirit, I think we're all going to have to go to space at some point anyway. Why not get it out of the way?
And in your lifetime, you think everyone will have to go to space?
Well, the way Al Gore makes it seem, yeah.
Well,
but I think at some point, where else is there to go? We've discovered the entire planet for the most part. And
well, we could start fixing the planet that we've...
We can do both. We can do both. Let's look what's happening here, but also look to the stars. I'd love the opportunity to go to a different planet and experience gravity and see a different night sky, maybe.
I would totally go.
It'd be incredible.
I think as long as I can come back. I don't want to live in space, but I would absolutely go.
It's like a weekend in Sarasota. You know, you just go for a little bit, but you don't stay.
312-981-7200. What are your thoughts on this idea of being able to buy a ticket to space, the privatization of space travel, because we're talking all about space tonight. So give us a call again, 312-981-7200, and let us know what you think about that, because there's an argument to be made of like, no, we're good. This is our planet. We're just fine. Thank you.
What is the absolute most you would pay to go to space? Like, what says, no way, it's too expensive, I can't afford that?
Let's put this in perspective. Rent is due here in a few days, and I have $19 in my wallet right now. So right now, 15 of those dollars is what I would pay for space.
But like from a ratio standpoint, that's a lot.
Sure, you know? Sure.
You'd pay a lot of the money that you have right now available to you to go to space.
Sure. I mean, I don't know. I'm trying to think of like, okay, how much does it cost to fly? Like, I flew to South Africa. Mm-hmm. Not on my dime. I was working there. But the ticket was about $1,000. So I'm like, okay, let's do it by mile. That's how I'm trying to figure that out. I don't know. I have no idea what. I'm sure millions to get to space.
Yeah. Oh, no doubt. Just, but who knows? Maybe as Jeff Bezos gets involved, he's the king of making things cost less. That's he's true. Even brought down the prices on Whole Foods, bring down the prices on space travel, man.
As we will see on Monday, he has claimed that a lot of prices at Whole Foods are going to go down significantly. So we'll be looking at that for sure. We were talking about that earlier today on the business lunch. I don't know. I think it's an exciting time at the very least. You know, when I was a kid, I thought, I mean, I've always been interested in space. And so I know a lot of kids are. I think astronaut seems like a very feasible job choice when you're six.
You just put on the helmet and you go.
You're like, yeah, sure, I'm going to do that. So, I mean, I think I think there's a ton of people that would go if they had the means to do so. But I would love to hear from an argument of someone from someone who's just like, no way, I'm not going to do it. Also, speaking of space, because that's what we're doing tonight on the program, we're talking all about space. It is a very important anniversary, and important may not be the word, but an interesting anniversary. It was 11 years ago this week that poor Pluto got demoted.
Oh,
R.I.P.
I remember it fondly.
R.I.P. Pluto. So if you will recall, there was an intense debate. Astronomers resolved to demote Pluto finally. There was a lot of discussion about it. And interestingly, people reacted pretty strongly to it. I think because, you know, you're brought up being taught these are the planets. This is what we got. This is what it is. Mm-hmm. Act accordingly. To me, if very well-trained scientists, I am not a scientist. And if a very well-trained scientist that is a very smart person and they know what they're doing, if they decide it no longer qualifies to be a planet, great. It's no longer a planet. The only way that impacts my life directly is that the mnemonic device that we all learned in school about how to remember all the planets suddenly doesn't quite, you know.
Yeah, it doesn't work out anymore, really.
Because if you will recall, it was my very educated mother just served us 9 pickles. Mm-hmm. And so
then pickles are out of the window.
Now it's just like my very educated mother just served us nothing. That's what it is. That's what it became.
Well, it was a weird moment because, I mean, not to show my age here, but I was in sixth grade.
You were?
I was in sixth grade when we were told the news. And it was a strange paradigm shift because when you're told these things growing up, you assume that, when you're told a fact about space, then that must just be constantly true. So Pluto is a planet. It'll never not be a planet unless Pluto ceases to exist. But then they told us, a bunch of people got in a room and said, yeah, you know what? It's not really a planet anymore. So Pluto is no longer a planet. And it seemed like kind of a paradigm shift for me because that's when I realized that space is so much bigger than what we really perceive. You know what I mean? Yeah. No, the minute Pluto became not a planet, I was like, whoa, anything is possible. The sky can be green, you know, who knows, black holes could be wormholes to a different dimension.
Yeah.
That's the best part about space is that for everything we think we know, there's so much more that we don't.
Well, so a space moment for me, I was of school age when the Challenger exploded. Mm-hmm. And that was such a big deal. And there was a teacher on it and it was, and a woman, you know, it was such a big deal. And there was so much conversation leading up to it. And then, you know, it was shown, I don't know if it would have been treated the same way now as it was then, but it was specifically shown to all of us. Mm-hmm. We were gathered into the auditorium and we were shown, and I remember teachers were crying, and it was really, it was kind of this reconciling moment in which we all kind of had to say, okay, this cool, big, infinite thing that is exciting and we've been looking at, we have our, you know, little models of planets in the classroom and stuff like that. We suddenly had to have this kind of healthy respect and fear of it, of like, look at, we had kind of had to confront mortality in a way.
Yeah.
I think a lot of school age kids, even very young kids at the time, were shown that. I mean, I know people that were like kindergarten, first grade at the time that remember very clearly being shown that and being discussed really clearly with them about, well, things have gone wrong and we're just, not there yet. And it was kind of the limits of human ability at that time. Yeah. Of, you know, we make mistakes and things go terribly wrong.
Yeah, especially when you have 20 years, you know, 20, 30 years of like incredible progress.
Right, right.
Like you're sending people to the moon. Everybody's going in orbit. It's the space race. It's like you think as far as people knew, it could be Star Trek in 20 years from then. And then with the Challenger, as you said, it's a reminder. It's saying that these are real people whose lives are in the balance, who are working with things that are difficult and require education and real careful planning, and sometimes those things don't go so well, and it takes a lot of bravery to put yourself into that situation. So
sure.
I know when I first saw the Challenger video, I was just like, wow, it's a beautiful but terrifying
right.
thing, this space exploration game.
Right, and I think that as things like SpaceX have started to experiment and launch and you know, do practice runs and things like that, I don't think there's many that, you know, that see when it has gone wrong, mm-hmm. That don't think of the Challenger. I mean, even when I see a launch televised and that rocket booster releases from the craft, that was the moment that started to happen. And so I always think of the Challenger. And I think it's interesting that space is kind of an interesting milestone, even for those of us who have nothing to do with it. You know,
I
like, for where were you when you saw the moon landing being televised? Where were you in the Challenger? Where were you, in your case, Pluto, when Pluto was demoted? So there's that. So, I think it is the reconciliation of science and kind of our adventure spirit, pioneering into new frontiers with, at the end of the day, you know, very fragile human bodies that are not indestructible, right? So it is a fascinating thing, space travel. So that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. We are going to take a break and go to news. When we return, we're going to be talking about that privatized space travel and looking at some people in the tech community working in that space and some of the kind of ethical issues that raises and considerations when you're coming at this from a tech background rather than a scientific one per se. So we're going to be taking a look at that, SpaceX and some other players in that space. A little bit later, we are going to be talking about the eclipse and some experiments that were conducted specifically during the eclipse, that could only be conducted during the eclipse, in fact, what we learned from them, and taking a look at the study of space and all of its many considerations, probably not all of them, to be fair. It is infinite, you guys. But nonetheless, we're going to look at a lot of them, and we have Michelle Nichols from the Adler Planetarium, who you will probably remember. She was on earlier in the summer to help us get ready for the eclipse. So she'll be joining us, and she is great and has tons of knowledge. And then after that, we're going to be talking with a political science professor who's going to talk with us a bit about how the space race and the civil rights movement happened concurrently and how they informed one another. Very, very interesting topic. I'm really excited to get into. So we're going to take a break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we pick one big topic and talk about many different aspects of it. Tonight is no different. We're talking all about space tonight. Of course, on the heels of the big eclipse, a lot of people were looking up at the skies. A lot of people were thinking about other issues connected to the eclipse and other things that have to do with space. So I immediately thought of a really fascinating book. It is called Driver in a Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create Our Future. Its co-author, Alex Salkiver, is on the phone with us. He is also the CMO of Mozilla. Alex, welcome to the program. So lovely to have you with us tonight.
Hi, thanks for having me on, actually. One quick correction. I am not the CMO of Mozilla. I am no longer in that job. I am working on books and writing projects full-time.
Oh, my mistake. I'm sorry. Well,
no problem.
It is a fine book, and that is a great move because it's a great book. I love it. I have interviewed your co-author before a while back, and that is how the book first got on my radar, and I really found it very fascinating, particularly some of the ethical considerations that are raised in the book that I think are really, really fascinating. But kind of talk us through this. Give us sort of a table setter here as we think about the privatization of space travel and a lot of tech players playing in this space area. What where are we right now, and where are we looking to go next?
So there's been a bunch of big successes with Elon Musk's company, also some with Jeff Bezos's company, that are in the process of really trying to privatize large chunks of space travel, which was formerly, or at this point, primarily satellite launch and putting things into space. And they've been extraordinarily successful. I mean, Elon Musk has won all kinds of contracts with SpaceX. He's also tested and actually successfully tested a reusable rocket engine, which would in theory make putting things into orbit considerably cheaper because you don't have to build a new rocket engine every time you launch things. You also have lots of other interesting things happening in satellites. So there's three or four companies that are putting up smaller satellites. They call them microsatellites or mini satellites to do things like create an alternative GPS network to give us satellite-driven broadband. In lots of parts of the U.S. and other parts of the world that are rural, you don't have good broadband, so this will start to take care of that. So we're really seeing the privatization and, to a certain degree, the democratization of space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is an interesting note to include that word, too. But with that, I think a lot of ethical concerns seem to come up quickly, particularly around security and espionage, things like that. I mean, recently was talking with a reporter on the show about Planet Labs, who has launched these many, many tiny satellites in hopes of photographing every single possible angle of the Earth, and all of the interesting ethical considerations there that I thought were really interesting, too.
So along with the democratization of space probably comes the end of visual privacy to a certain degree. If it is outdoors, it will likely be photographed or easy to photograph pretty quickly. Now, granted, in cities, this is already kind of a fait accompli because of all the video camera coverage. And to a certain degree, we've all given up our privacy anyway without thinking about it. But as you get the Earth blanketed by more and more of these smaller satellites, giving greater and greater coverage of everything that's out there, yes, we do start to lose that. And you also start to have questions about what's okay to take pictures of, what to do with the data, who owns the data. There's lots of issues around that I think will probably play out in the near future.
Right, right. And so shifting our focus specifically on privatizing space travel and kind of the prospect of that, because I think when that was first mentioned, when we first saw that, we saw very wealthy celebrities going, sure, I'd pay to do that. But then as we've gone down that line, it becomes a little more feasible that perhaps in our lifetimes, it will be theoretically possible to buy a ticket and travel to space relatively safely and relatively, accessibly. So with that, a lot of stuff comes up, because when we see privatization, with that comes a lot about data and a lot about funding and profit. And then that is about, ethics and trust and all that. And so where do you fall on that and the idea of a commercial space travel?
So I think commercial space travel is wonderful when it gets here. And I'm actually not as worried about ethics around that, because it's a strange situation where the people that have the money or the people that want to go up first are actually going to be the guinea pigs. Usually sort of those who have the money get the best of everything and they get things first. In this case, because space travel is so risky, the folks that want to go up there are truly the pioneers. Now, when it comes to ethics around data collection or around, potentially something like who gets to escape the Earth first if things are really bad down here for some reason, and that's, way, way out and very scary stuff, then yes, it starts to be a question. If we are better off on Mars for some reason or another, then is it fair that only people that have money could get there? It really depends a lot on the context and other things in the situation. I'd also steer us to one other area that I think is really interesting as well, which is that it may be possible that certain kinds of things like medical treatments will be better in space for certain types of conditions. And in those situations, it might actually be that, there is a real disparity between what's possible for the everyman and what's possible for the people with means.
Are there any hypotheses there on the chopping block of specific medical conditions that might theoretically be treated more effectively in space?
Not yet. I was jumping way out ahead on that one. But when you look at certain things, they do tend to grow better in space. So certain types of bacterial cultures or certain types of nutrients can be grown. So there might be situations where a zero-gravity environment would prolong life or would make it easier on things. Now, in general, space is tough on people for the most part, because usually you tend to lose bone density and muscle mass. But I could envision out in the future something like that might happen. And that's really kind of a what-if case. I mean, another thing that's really interesting is, when we have all these satellites or space vehicles, what are the ethics of space warfare or what are the rules? If, for example, a Russian satellite, it goes up and starts to take out U.S. GPS satellites, and this could cause lots of problems. What are the resources out there in space? So we already have, I believe, two U.S. companies, one by Peter Diamandis, and I'm trying to think of the other one, that are planning to try to go to mine asteroids for precious metals.
That does bring up a lot of interesting considerations, which immediately I also think of how much NASA has been in the political narrative as we're talking about funding, as we're talking about things like that. And so it is interesting to also be considering aspects of space exploration and advancement being privatized in a time when perhaps public funding is in peril.
And in a sense, I have mixed feelings about it. On the one hand, NASA has done some absolutely amazing things that led to tremendous breakthroughs. When you look at the Apollo program, the space shuttle program, it's not clear that private industry could have done that. On the other hand, it's possible. And as we get to a position where space lift becomes much more of a commodity, then it may make more sense for them to essentially put out a tender bid on an orbiter for Saturn and say, okay, let's put the best equipment into that orbiter and see what happens, and whoever creates the lowest two bids, you get to send it up. Because realistically, most of the technology that goes into space now, for various reasons, one of which just that the process tends to be very slow in the government, it's kind of old technology, and so there's a theory that private sector will be able to accelerate that. On the other hand, when you look at the technology that Elon Musk is using, that Jeff Bezos is using, it's different, it's better, but it's not necessarily a whole lot newer than the traditional space lift that we were doing back, with the Apollo rockets. I mean, the technology is still pretty much the same for burning a propellant to shoot objects into space.
Right, right. And so we're talking about things that are on the horizon, some distant horizon, some more reachable. What about some more current and practical applications? I'm thinking right away of just in the last 48 hours, we have been able to look at Hurricane Harvey in a much more detailed way and have a lot more data about it prior to it making landfall, simply because we were able to look at it from space with really sophisticated equipment. Are there any other weather or safety, anything like that, practical applications that we're already seeing as a result of this expansion?
There are many, many of them, and some of them overlap with drones, and some of them overlap with the Planet Labs technology, which you mentioned. So, for example, there is now a group, it's a nonprofit group, I believe, that is doing essentially ocean-wide coverage of illegal fishing operations, where they combine artificial intelligence with nearly ubiquitous and relatively cheap satellite coverage to be able to zero in on ships that look like they are engaging in illegal fishing, and then direct resources or direct, military forces to go intercept those ships. In the past, this was a tremendous problem because the ocean was vast, and it was very hard to just patrol around the ocean and find these guys. Well, if you have really great space technology that can show you where they are and they can't hide as easily, then we might have a chance to really slow down some of the radical depletion of our ocean resources.
which is really fascinating. I mean, I'm immediately also thinking of other environmental applications when we're thinking about, you know, even perhaps endangered species and endangered types of land, things like that. Deforestation, I think there's probably a similar application.
Very much so. And also on the flip side of that, you're starting to see many more uses of imaging, because that's essentially what these satellites are doing, and sensors for really neat study of agriculture. So they're starting to get to capabilities where they can take different imagery of what fields look like and advise you on what nutrients you need to put into the ground. This is much more efficient than going out and sticking a sensor in every row of crops and trying to understand soil composition. So there's many, many ways that space will become incredibly beneficial to all of us and give us things much more cheaply than we had in the past.
That is a really fascinating application, too. I love that we're using this so practically right now. And then when we shift back to thinking about specifically the business part of that, what does that economy look like maybe in even the next 5 years? What does it seem? I mean, I know that's kind of putting you on the spot to be a bit of a futurist, but, what is the most likely scenario of where we would see the biggest economic growth in this space in the next few years?
So SpaceX is already a multi-billion-dollar company, and that came, it's been a long time getting there, but that has grown into a large economic opportunity. I think there's probably room for a number of others in the launch space, but I think really where you will see the huge growth in economic opportunities is services and information derived from things that are being done with satellites or things that are being done in orbit. For example, when we talk about Planet Labs, if what they do becomes a really broadly available business model, then that could be billions and billions of dollars a year in sales, because there's so many things that people could use the imaging or the sensors on the satellites for. And you're starting to see, other interesting opportunities. For example, I'm not sure if this is Planet Labs. I'm blanking on the name of the other company that does this, but I've read about them a couple times. They will actually shoot your science experiments into space, because certain types of science experiments, you have to be run in orbit. So I think, like, that's a service business. So that's where I see the real the real long-term giant pot of money. I think the launches will be important. I think that those will be really neat. And I think that that will always be sort of a keystone, and you see it in companies like Boeing and Lockheed. But I think the real interesting growth will be in the services, the software, all of the components that layer on top of it, which deliver real value back into our economy.
That is really, really fascinating. I don't know where that service was when I was in the fourth grade science fair, but I could have used that to launch something into space.
It's pretty remarkable, and actually when you look at the cost, some high schools are doing that now.
Wow, what a fascinating resource for students right now. How wonderful. And so when we talk about, when we have this conversation, because I know this is a topic you are talking about a lot, given your expertise in the area, what is often missing from that conversation? What's maybe missing from the main narrative, or something that we often overlook, or something that we look the wrong direction on?
Do you mean with regard to space?
Yeah, particularly around innovation around space.
So I think that a lot of people are probably a little too, and we touched on this in the last conversation, a little too focused on the idea of launching, and probably not thinking as much about some of the smaller businesses that are on top of this. I also think that that when we go and look at space in general, I think that one of the things that we probably miss quite a bit, which is tied to the NASA cutbacks and tied to other things, is the long-term importance, of really maintaining our sensor capabilities for things like monitoring global warming, for things like, monitoring meteorites and asteroids. Searching for extrasolar planets. All of these things they're more out on the bleeding edge, and they are more to serve humanity. And those are all in the crosshairs at this moment. Lots of them are really at risk because so much of the federal government is under threat that way. And these are the type of projects where probably NASA are the right folks to do it. I mean, we were looking at extrasolar planet detection or asteroid detection with the military. And frankly, these are, even though they're out there, they're kind of existential threats. We don't necessarily think about them all the time. And then, it's something we probably take for granted. But, we all should remember that when an asteroid does strike the Earth, we probably want to know about it as soon as possible before it happens.
Sure. And
there have been catastrophic problems with this in the past, obviously. We can ask the dinosaurs about that.
Right. Or can't, as the case may be.
Exactly.
Right, indeed. Indeed. Well, this is all so fascinating, and I love kind of putting on, getting into future mode and imagining all the things that can be and all the things that are right now. I think that's so fascinating. So I really appreciate you joining us tonight and talking about this. The book is called Driver in a Driverless Car, How Our Technology Choices Will Create Our Future. I have read this book and I highly recommend it. It is really, really fascinating. So thank you so much, Alex Salkiever, for being with us tonight, co-author of the book.
Thanks for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks so much. All right. We are going to take a little break and get you to news here in just a bit. Back in a moment on 720 WGN. WGN. Thanks for being with us. I'm Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. As ever, we take one big topic and we spend the entire show talking all about it and different aspects of it. Tonight is no different. On the heels of the eclipse, we are talking about space because so many of us were looking up, hopefully with protected eyes, at the eclipse, either under totality or under the partial eclipse as we had here. So if you will recall, regular listeners of the show will for sure, earlier in the summer, we had a very special guest on to help us get ready for the eclipse. And we were talking about the history of eclipses and how people used to act when we didn't know what that thing was in the sky. We thought maybe there was just a hole in the sky. We talked about that. We talked about what to expect from this eclipse that we just experienced, which was very cool. And I hope you got a great view of it from wherever you're listening from. But she was on. She is the master educator in the astronomy department right here at the Adler Planetarium. Please welcome back to the program, Michelle Nichols. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me back.
Well, so I was looking at social media during the eclipse, as a lot of people were, and I saw you looking so happy down in Carbondale. You looked just delighted to be down there. Tell us, what was it like? I was here in Chicago, but down there in the path of totality, what was that like?
So it actually started, we were down there the Monday prior to the eclipse, doing outreach programs all over the area, and it just, the excitement was just building, and people were wondering, how bad is the traffic going to get? How dark is it going to get in the sky? And what is it going to be like when everybody descends on the Carbondale area? And so we kept seeing the same people here and there, and just it was just magical leading up to it. And then the day of, the only thing I can say is nobody throws an eclipse party like Southern Illinois University throws an eclipse party. It was insane and amazing and awesome. And at this point, this is where the English language fails me, because while in the stadium itself, we actually only saw totality, or at least I only saw totality for a few seconds right at the beginning, because there was a cloud literally right over the stadium. And so it wasn't exactly frustrating because I did see it. I can at least say we saw it. And depending on where you were in the stadium or if you were right outside the stadium, you saw it for more time or less. Just that little bit of distance made a big difference. But, hey, we saw it, and the sky got dark, and we were all there together looking up. And that was the most amazing part, was all those people were there, probably 50,000 in Carbondale approximately. Everyone was there to look up at the sky.
Isn't that cool? It was, you know, you prepared me really well for it. You know, I was thinking, oh, we're going to miss it completely here in Chicago. But, you know, I kept that number. He was like, oh, it's like 87%. You'll be able to see it in Chicago. And indeed, it was cloudy here too, but I had lots of lenses out. I had lots of stuff going on. I was on my back balcony, and I had a viewing box that I made. I had lots of stuff happening, and I was able to see it even for just a second there. You could just see it turn into a sliver, and it was cool. And you know what? I surprised myself. I didn't imagine that it would have any emotional impact. I just thought, this is going to be really, really cool. I love space stuff. But there was a second where I was looking through the viewer gadget, and I really caught this very beautiful glimpse, and I got a little choked up, I will admit. And it was fascinating to me, because then I, you know, go back to social media and I see, in fact, even our very own Tom Skilling got quite choked up very endearingly. And I think it's so interesting. Here's something that's mathematical and logical and scientific, and yet can still bring out these stunning emotions in people.
Yeah, and I mean, I got a chance to meet Tom on Sunday, the Sunday prior to the eclipse, and I will tell everybody, he is exactly the same in person as he is on TV. He is such a nice guy. And so I was thrilled that he was down in Macanda, which is just south of Carbondale, and he got to see totality. That just made me so happy when I saw that, because he is just a happy, nice, awesome guy.
And he really is.
Yeah. And so, but the whole place was filled with folks who were there to, I'm sure people understood, yes, the sun and the moon and the earth line up and we get it. And just as you said, we get it. We can predict it, but there's something about seeing it with your own eyes. You feel the temperature drop. And actually I started noticing the temperature drop maybe about half an hour prior to totality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that was pretty neat. And it was also very welcome, considering it was extraordinarily hot down there that day. And it was when totality happened, my husband was there too. And he said, you know what? Right when I saw it, I gasped. Mm. And I think that surprised him, because you instantly feel this connection. And I'm going to sound all new agey, but I don't mean to. But you instantly get this connection and you go, oh, universe, got it. We're here.
Right.
We get it.
Right.
So, yeah, for just those few moments.
Yeah, definitely. It was really, really beautiful. And so there's this stadium, there's what do you say, 50,000 people there. What was that tone? Was it silent when totality hit, or was it cheering, or a little bit of both?
It was a little bit of apprehension because it was cloudy right up until then. So it was clear all morning, and then the clouds started building a bit, and then maybe, oh, I don't know, 20 minutes prior to totality, we actually had a cloud right over the stadium. And I don't know enough about the physics of air to know if maybe the stadium developed its own little heat island right there. And possibly cloud developed right over it. I don't know. I'm sure that's not explaining all of it correctly. But so people, I think, were a little apprehensive going, are we going to see this thing?
Sure.
And then right before totality, it did clear up a little bit. And so we got to see the last few moments. And then it was still some thin cloud in a little spot. And so for a moment, for a few seconds, I got to see a bit of the corona. I got to see a bit of the pink prominences, those little big protrusions of gas off the edge of the sun. So I know I saw it, but during totality itself, it clouded up again. And I think people were going, uh-oh, are we going to miss seeing totality again? And so then about 30, 40 seconds prior to the end of totality, people started cheering. You could hear them outside the stadium and in the southwest end of the stadium as well. It depended on where you were. They got it for maybe 10, 20, 30, 40 seconds. And I was literally in the middle of the field. I parked myself pretty much in the middle of the football field. And I think if I had started running south toward the south end zone, I might have seen totality for a bit at the end. But hey, I can say I saw it.
Yeah, you saw it. Very cool. We are talking right now with Michelle Nichols, who is the master educator in the astronomy department at Adler Planetarium, who is down in Carbondale for the event. If you are connected to her or the Adler on social media, you saw her looking so darn happy. You couldn't help but smile on all of the pictures that were on social media. We are going to take a little break, but when we continue, we're going to continue this conversation, because I know there were some experiments that were done that could only be done during the eclipse. And I want to talk a little bit about the study of space and the work that you do at the Adler that is so cool and so very important. So we will be right back to continue this conversation with Michelle Nichols from the Adler Planetarium back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Black hole sun, won't you come? Wash me. 720 WGN. Shout out to esteemed producer Tom Hush for playing lots of, let's say, space and celestial themed music tonight as we have been going in and out of break. So shout out to him. An excellent DJ as always. Well, this is the Saturday Night Special. I'm Amy Guth, and I appreciate you being with us tonight. Always a pleasure to share Saturday with you. So we are talking all about space tonight, and of course we're doing that because we're on the heels of that marvelous eclipse that, even if you weren't in the path of totality, it was still pretty darn cool. I watched it here in Chicago, and I was quite impressed with that little display happening in the skies above. So if you will recall, earlier in the summer, prior to the eclipse and all of that, we had Michelle Nichols from the Adler Planetarium on the program. She's a master educator in the astronomy department. She was on getting us ready for the eclipse and giving us some background on the eclipse. And we had so much fun. We had to bring her back on because she was down there in Carbondale in the path of totality and, according to social media, completely enjoying herself. You looked like you were having so much fun, Michelle. So I'm so glad that you're with us tonight to talk about the eclipse and all of those things. But so from what I understand, there were some experiments that a lot of different scientists around the country were able to do during the eclipse that couldn't be done otherwise, or that they wanted to do specifically during the time of the eclipse. Can you tell us a bit about that, and maybe if there were some specific ones that you or your team from the Adler did?
So we weren't involved with any of their research projects, but the Southern Illinois University folks were. So there was a project called Citizen Kate, and they scattered the same type of telescope all along the path of totality. Quite a number of sites had the same equipment, and what they were getting data on was, of course, the sun and the solar corona. So the main thing that you can do during totality is, for those few seconds or few minutes, you can see the entire corona, which is the sun's outer atmosphere. This is the region in which the sun or the Earth swims, essentially. And so we're touched by the solar wind, the material's constantly streaming off the sun. And so there's a problem, though, that with our main spacecraft and telescopes that we use to study the sun, basically we have spacecraft to study the sun, spacecraft to study the corona, and where you have spacecraft to study the sun, but they don't study the corona, and vice versa. So there's a gap between where studying the sun stops and where studying the corona starts. And so this enabled those telescopes to all get data on the inner corona, which is the inner part of that region, that wispy white stuff that you see during totality. And then that will enable scientists to put all that data together and learn more about why or how the corona works, why it's so hot, because there's a lot we don't know. Now, it's going to take a while for that data to come out. It's probably going to be, I would imagine, at least a year before they've been able to tackle it all and really come up with some interesting conclusions. But that was one type of study that was done during the eclipse itself.
Which sounds extremely cool, because I think that was part of what made that was kind of part of the gasp, right? When people see that and you gasp and it kind of takes you aback. Part of it is those beautiful little wisps of the inner corona looking at, like, because we don't see those. We just think of little sun rays.
Right, and you don't realize that it looks even more amazing in person than it does through pictures, because pictures, you really got to work at the pictures to get them to look like what you actually see with your eyes in the sky. So it's really something to see it in person.
Indeed, indeed. So you do so much cool stuff at the Adler, and we're so lucky that we have the Adler right here in our fine city. And it seems like because of the eclipse, we have this big surge of interest in all the stuff going on in the sky right now and in space. How do we keep that interest high? And how do, you know, what can people do who have maybe the eclipse has piqued their interest? Are there programs at the Adler that people could go maybe attend and learn more, or things like that, that I think it maybe kind of whet the appetite for a lot of people to kind of get into space stuff?
Yeah, we have quite a few ways for people to tap into that. So I'm in charge of our public observing programs. So all of the programs that have to do with looking up at the sky and telescope observing and all of that, that's all me. And so things like Scopes in the City, where we take telescopes out to various locations in the Chicago area and in suburbs. And so I was at the Warrenville Library with a telescope, and just anyone walking by can look up, and showing people that the sky is not totally hopeless over the city, and that we can still see some really neat things. And so I would invite people to visit our website and check out where our telescopes are going to be, because we go to a variety of locations all over the city, and in the suburbs too, but mostly in the city of Chicago. We have opportunities for people to attend lectures from time to time. We've got our Adler After Dark 21 and over event happening every month, which sells out quickly. So if people want to get tickets, I highly recommend they do that. They do that pretty soon. We have our observatory open from time to time. When there's some celestial event happening in the sky, we'll cover it, such as the lunar eclipse coming up at the end of January. So we got one of those coming up. So we're going to start planning for that pretty soon. So there are lots of ways for people to tap in. That was just a real quick overview of just a few things, but there's a lot more that we offer.
Yeah, and I think I remember when you were on the program before, you were talking about a program with telescopes on the 606.
Right, correct. So the 606 trail is, I'm sure, well known to folks who live near it, and you probably heard of it if you don't live right near it, but it's an east-west trail that I think follows an old elevated rail system. Well, the rail has been taken out, and you've got this really nice curvy bike path. And so we take telescopes out usually around the equinoxes. So for this next one, it is, and as I'm talking here, I'm going to check my calendar really quickly, because we have the next date coming up in September. Give me just a sec.
Right, usually around like the 20th or so.
Around there. It is the 22nd.
Okay.
It is Friday, September 22nd. It's not exactly on the equinox. We usually try to have the date right around there. So it's the 22nd from 7:15 to 9. That is weather permitting. We have a backup date, which is Monday, September 25th. So if 22nd turns out to be cloudy, then we'll try to go back out on the 25th. All depends on what the clouds give us, but we'll give it a try. Usually September is pretty good weather. So
yeah.
So it's usually a good one to shoot for.
It's always the clouds here. I remember the last time, I think it was the Perseid meteor shower, like 2 or 3 years in a row, nothing, because it was all clouds.
Yep. Yeah, August is not always friendly to clouds. I wish we had a nice bright meteor shower in September.
Right.
September is usually nice and clear and dry and comfortable. So anyway.
Yeah. So the you kind of already answered my next question. That is, what is the next big thing happening in the sky? But it sounds like perhaps it's the January lunar eclipse.
Yes. So that is January 31st. It starts around 5 in the morning. It's going to be the moon is going to be in the process of setting. So we're not going to see all of the lunar eclipse, but it will get into totality. So so it'll start around 5 in the morning, and totality will start somewhere, I don't have the times off the top of my head, it's somewhere around 6:30-ish, something like that, in the morning. And then it's going to set during totality. So we're not going to see the end of totality or the end of the eclipse. But as soon as I get back into the office, and we all get solar eclipsed out, and we'll be back to planning for this next one in January.
That sounds super fun. Well, I will be there for sure. So many cool things coming from Adler, and we all appreciate all of the cool stuff that you do to keep us informed and keep us learning. They're all very fun. So I assume we can just go to the Adler website and find out more about that stuff.
Absolutely. www.adlerplanetarium.org.
Marvelous. Michelle Nichols, thank you so much for being with us and checking in about what looked like a very fun time in Carbondale during totality.
Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon.
All right.
Okay, we are going to take a break and get you to news, all that fun stuff, back here in just a bit on 720 WGN.
And I think it's going to be a long, long time. Touchdown brings me round again to find
720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth, and this is the Saturday Night Special. As this song suggests, we're talking all about space tonight, so we couldn't possibly close out the show without a little of this song, for sure. Few more coming up, though. We got more on the playlist. So we have been talking all about space. We've been talking about the privatization of space travel and some very interesting advances in the tech space. We were talking with Michelle Nichols from the Adler Planetarium, who is down in Carbondale during totality and working on very cool stuff right here at the Adler and keeping us informed and keeping us thinking and looking up at the skies and all that. And we are joined now by Dr. John Turris, who is a political science professor at LaGrange College. Welcome him to the program. Hi, Dr. John. How are you?
Doing just fine. You did a great job with my last name.
Oh, thank you. I with a last name like Guth, I always, I'm always nervous about that. You know, we have something very interesting in common. I, too, am a Texan natively and have also spent time at the Alamogordo Space Center, which I noticed in your bio preparing for the show tonight, reading up about you and your work. I noticed that you spent time there. So space has been a thing that you have been interested in for a while as well.
That's right. In fact, I was first came interested in it when we moved from downtown Milwaukee to El Paso, Texas. And around this time, it was the end of the Apollo missions. And little kid friends of mine wrote letters to me and said, "What's it like?" And I responded, "It's like the moon, because it looked nothing like I had ever seen out in West Texas that you would see in Chicago or downtown Milwaukee."
Certainly. Certainly, that's the case. Indeed, West Texas is very, very different from Milwaukee. Okay, so you wrote a piece on Huffington Post that is really, really fascinating, that pulls two things together in a moment in time in a really fascinating way. And that was the way that the space race and the civil rights movement occurred and quite separately, but yet informed each other and the pop culture around it in a really, really interesting way. Talk us through that piece, if you would.
Sure. I'll be glad to do that. I've written about race and politics some, and of course I was interested in space. But believe it or not, it wasn't until the movie Hidden Figures came out that I became very interested, and I thought about it. Oh, you know, wait a second. These things were going on at the same time. It wasn't just, I think I made mention to desegregating the U.S. military, the way Jackie Robinson broke into baseball in the 1940s. In NASA, it took a little longer, but I think that as the movie illustrates, it's something that you needed all Americans to be involved in if we were going to catch up with the Soviets.
Certainly, certainly. And through the piece, you talk a bit about how those two things informed each other. And I think in particular, those two things being the civil rights movement and the space race, how they informed each other, but also some of the results of them, one of them being the creation of Star Trek and kind of how that really carried a lot more weight than perhaps we often give it credit for.
Yeah, we showed a few Star Trek episodes to the kids before we went to NASA, and they didn't seem to notice anything unusual about it because our kids go to pretty diverse schools. But to think that on a TV show you would have not only a Russian, but you would have somebody who is Asian American, you would have someone who's African American. I mean, it was a diverse group that I'm not sure that was reflected everywhere else on TV.
Right, certainly. And so what are some other ways that those two things perhaps not informed each other, but impacted one another or or had interesting overlap, or even maybe even not at the time, but now seem to have really fascinating overlap. Go ahead.
Believe it or not, during this time I was teaching an online course called The American Experience, and we were doing research on the American Revolution. And typically it's taught as, you know, old men with wigs, and that's the only people who should care about it. But as my students discovered in their research projects, it was a very diverse affair. You had young people, old people. You had a racially diverse group. You had women participate as well. And the class was very diverse itself. The way that this connects to space is after, you know, initial years of it being mostly a whites-only club, when it became more diverse in terms of race, when it became more diverse in terms of gender or so, I think that it built up the excitement in Americans to say, oh, that's just like me, or, you know, it's not somebody else's success. This is all of our success.
Mm-hmm.
One of the students taking that class, I have to do a little presentation about themselves, and he said, I went to Ronald McNair High School, and he even had a picture of Ronald McNair, the astronaut. And I thought, wow, who includes a picture of the person that you went to school with on your own bio?
Right.
Unless you thought it was important.
Right. Certainly. So in your work as a political science professor and in that space, I have to assume that modern political discussions, particularly around funding and innovation in the space arena and privatization and, you know, as we're talking about budgets and things like that, where is the social impact of all that in your mind beyond the obvious points of education and access and things like that?
Well, I'll start off with what I would consider kind of a painful family story. I married a Floridian. She is now a language arts teacher and teaches our kids in school. Her sister is a physicist at Columbus State. And both gals took a lot of pride that their grandfather was a Geminier. He worked on the Gemini project.
Very cool.
When their father, yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, we were able to show Gemini capsule, and they could say, my grandfather worked on that. But what was really terrible is when my father-in-law passed away and they were going through his files, they found his layoff notice from the mid-1970s due to budget cuts. I mean, they had to let a lot of people, the space program, go. I mean, it almost killed the program.
Mm.
And I feel like we're kind of in a similar time, or it looked like we were in a similar time just a couple of years ago after the space shuttle was mothballed. You still have scientific experiments going on. You still have launches. But when we went over to NASA, it was nice to see that and talk to everyone and hear that numbers are jumping at NASA. There's a lot of excitement. Where does it come from? What you were talking about previously, privatization of space. There are launches now all the time. And people are thinking, wow, you know, this is something that could happen in my lifetime, space travel.
Certainly. And so you had mentioned the film Hidden Figures, which I think was a very essential one, a very important film. It got a lot of people having conversations about this very particular thing in a way that perhaps people maybe not very closely related to space, working in space, that field, you know, maybe weren't totally aware of. So I think it was an important film in that way because it brought that conversation to a little bit wider audience for consideration. What are the other opportunities there? What are the other things that we maybe overlook so much when we think about the space race, in particular as it applies to diversity?
Okay, two things. One, just that you mentioned that there were so many people involved. I mean, the film wasn't about astronauts, and it wasn't about people who were pushing the buttons. It was the people who were the mathematicians. Yet, I mean, their calculations were very necessary because you know, you get your calculations off and somebody's going to run out of oxygen. I think what the movie showed is sometimes when you see a civil rights film, like let's say Mississippi Burning, the racism you see is somebody gets beaten or somebody gets lynched. And you think, oh, as long as we don't do that, there's nothing wrong. But what Hidden Figures showed so well is the subtle racism, as much as, okay, you don't get a chance to use the bathroom, all right, but that means you have to go a mile and a half to use a different bathroom. And when everyone's on a tight schedule, you're set behind. In the case of the gal who wanted to go to school at night, well, I'm sorry, but you can only go to school during day, not at night. And night is the only time she can study the material, you know, go to class, get the credit to get ahead. That it shows a lot of subtle racism, I feel, that we don't think about. It's more than just lynchings and beatings. Sometimes it's something else where a person is put at a disadvantage only due to skin color.
That is a really very important point. I think that just that crystallized that so perfectly, because you're exactly right. When we think of race in cinema, often it is quite violent and quite overt and undeniable. But to put it in more subtle terms, I think is really quite effective and quite important to do so, because in fact, that's probably the more common experience, is that kind of death by a thousand cuts thing that we talk about, but is much harder to enforce or to regulate.
Definitely. And believe it or not, for contrast, I was watching the movie Good Night and Good Luck, which is TV in the 1950s. And it's overwhelmingly male dominated, whereas it looks very different today. The media does. But, you know, they didn't even have to say anything sexist or do anything. It just, there were not many women. And the only, most of the women you see have very lower level media jobs. Whereas I was a communication major, by the 1980s, things had changed dramatically. There were more women who were communication majors in our program than men.
Certainly. So I want to return to your Huffington Post piece again. And if you follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet this out after the program, because it's really, really a great one. I recommend that you read it by Dr. John Turris. So you're describing this scene that I think is so wonderful. I don't want to try to describe it for you. I want you to do it. But in particular, this scene where you're sitting there, you're at this table, and this kind of pivotal moment happens to you. Talk us through that, if you would.
Oh, my. I'm remembering it now. There was, when we're sitting at the table, this is my sister-in-law, the physicist, my wife, who's a language arts teacher, and our kids. And there was a, you know, family sat down next to us. They were also a large family. And we seemed to be having a very pleasant conversation about our days. And when I made an offhanded comment about, I mentioned something about, we were talking about anniversaries. And I said, oh, yeah, we're coming up on the anniversary when our school desegregated. And we actually have an African-American population at our college that's double the national average of African-Americans in the U.S. And the guy said, you know, he just said it like almost politely to me, or he thought he was polite. He said, oh, yeah, that's going to keep them out of trouble.
Oh, boy.
It got very awkward because, you know, we weren't ready to get up and, like, leave the area. But I was thinking, like, how could you say that? The sad thing is, I don't think he thought it was an unfair statement. I thought he just kind of, it just rolled off his tongue like, oh, like a conversational piece.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It might rain today because of Hurricane Harvey.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we've put a lot of thought into conversation around getting girls into STEM, and a little more conversation about getting supporting girls that then become women entering STEM fields. A little more conversation on that. Still more needed, I think. But I don't know that we're having as big a conversation about racial diversity in STEM fields, particularly at a young age. I think it's still kind of stuck in a conversation about getting girls involved in STEM.
Yeah. My sister-in-law, in fact, she is she's not the leader, but she is a leader in her Girl Scout troop. And she was able to get kids to go and see the film, and it seemed to be a very positive experience. I'll be honest, when I first wanted to see Hidden Figures, and I asked a couple of people, I said, hey, who wants to go see it? And a lot of people, even liberal-minded people, are like, I don't want to see that. I guess they feel that watching a film about racism can be uncomfortable. But what I think people miss the point is that you can also see a contrast to say, oh, that would be considered, that would not happen as likely today. You know, incidents like Charlottesville notwithstanding, it's pretty rare to see that today, whereas it's more commonplace then. But I think sometimes if the film seems to be kind of controversial, it's going to be edgy, it might get you out of your comfort zone. It does. It takes a little bit for someone to get to go over and see it.
Right. Well, and so we mentioned earlier, Star Trek as kind of an interesting cultural tell at that moment. And then we have this, you know, this modern contemporary film What about other things in the middle of those two? What about maybe even closer to the Star Trek realm, other things at that time where we saw perhaps influence of both the civil rights movement and space race happening beyond Star Trek? Were there smaller things that perhaps have kind of faded out of the narrative a little bit, or things that maybe are connected to those things that we don't think about being as connected?
I mean, the thing that whenever Star Trek comes out, I always find it interesting. I've asked students, you know, what do you think about Star Trek, or what, you know, the original series, what comes to your mind? And almost everybody says, oh, wasn't that the first ever interracial kiss? And I was like, I assume it. I mean, that's what I've heard. I haven't myth checked it, but I know it was a very early one that was considered very controversial at the time. And now nobody would think, now, you know, it seems like, when I say nobody would think, most people wouldn't think anything of it. I mean, I saw a poll today saying that like 89% of people completely reject white supremacy. Doesn't mean everybody does, but it would not be considered shocking to have an interracial kiss on television or in the movies. There's a TV show called Battlestar Galactica that sort of made a comeback a few years ago.
Sure.
And I was thinking about it. We were in a used bookstore, and they had a comic book from that time. And I looked, I said, oh, it's Battlestar Galactica. I remember, they had an African-American character who was pretty prominent. And I was like, I didn't even think about that. But, that's, what, the 1970s? That's only a few years after Star Trek went off the air.
And it is interesting, in that setting, in a sci-fi setting, there's always the ability to imagine a more evolved world. Imagine a place where there is, racial equality and gender equality and all of those things in a way that is perhaps maybe less threatening, right, to people holding on to ideas of the present. So I think sci-fi has a really interesting opportunity there, just as a genre, to do that. And that's exactly what we saw with Star Trek at the time.
Mm-hmm. Here's something else to mention. I mentioned the desegregation of the military, and I think that's one of the contributing factors to the space race. You'll notice in the movie that John Glenn doesn't seem to have a problem with African-American women. Well, in the war, he is most likely served with African-Americans. Baseball commissioner Happy Chandler, he was the commissioner who allowed Jackie Robinson to play. He cited serving with African-Americans in the military. And there was a conflict, you know, where America was at stake. We're one of the few countries who won a two-front war. And we did so with everyone on the same team. I'm going to take us a little bit away from space, and you might ask right now, well, what were the Soviets doing? Well, the Soviets were ahead of us on gender equality. They had a female astronaut, you know, flying not too far off from the days of Alan Shepard and John Glenn.
Right.
But how about for racially? Quick story. I was in Czechoslovakia right around the time the Berlin Wall fell, and I was with a couple of college friends, guys and gals, and we saw some of the Red Army in their last year kind of marching around, throwing their weight around a little bit, just intimidating the country one last chance before they officially left. And so we walked over to them to say, oh, let's see who these guys are. What's going on? And, well, first off, it was almost entirely male-dominated. The officers were what you would consider sort of white or European-style Russians. And almost every enlisted soldier would be from Central Asia or Siberia, very few people who were white. And I thought, oh, my gosh, this looked like something out of the movie Glory, where you only have white officers and you have African-American mm-hmm. soldiers.
Right.
And
right.
So I don't think Russia did the same in terms of letting everybody jumping in. That's just the military. But that's military in 1989, 1990.
Right. And then now, as we're in this moment in time where we see the tech space and the space realm kind of starting to blur and merge a bit, as we're seeing things like SpaceX and all that, Silicon Valley, widely criticized for a very homogenous work culture, widely criticized for that, even after, it seems like even leaders that try to step up to the plate to fix it, it only make it worse right now, it seems like. So where, you know, right now it seems like we're in this other interesting time where we have perhaps a little bit of progress in the space world, meeting an industry with perhaps very little progress in that diversity realm. You know, what is that opportunity now, and what is the big barrier in your mind as we see kind of politics and space and technology merging in this really interesting way, both in the publicly funded and the private sector?
I think it goes back to the need to show people role models. And usually when we hear about the heroes of Silicon Valley, they're portrayed as, you know, white, geeky teenagers. And, yeah, I went to college with a bunch of them. I mean, in my dorm, I was a political science person, and almost everybody else was computer science. And in some ways, they fit the stereotype, although they never came across with the view of women can't do this, or, you know, people who are non-white couldn't do this. And, in fact, we had a fairly diverse group of people. I think it's a different story when you get before the college. We don't need the, we don't need this as much in college to try and encourage others. I think it goes back to K through five. It's middle school, it's high school, being able to see role models. We had a guy who played football on our team, and he, he's a football player, but he was also the president of the chess club, and he was a math major who went to get his PhD. And, you know, there's all, you know, from North Carolina State University, he's a big star. And so we're promoting him. I think we'd promote anybody who got a PhD from us afterwards. But that's a good example of saying, look at what this gentleman has accomplished. And he's a math person. I mean, he's not just a smart person. I think you'll see African-Americans who look at, yeah, I could be a doctor, or I could get into political science, or, you know, I could be a politician. You don't see as much in math. And I think that's, you know, movies like Hidden Figures can change that.
Right. Well, and, you know, we talk a lot about representation and its importance. And I think it's more than just important. I think it's essential, really, to be able to, for a young child to look up and say, here's someone who looks like me doing this thing that maybe I could do too. I think that's really important. That's something my very favorite astronaut is Leland Marvin, who very famously posed with his dogs for his official NASA portrait. And he talks a lot about that with young children. I think he talks a lot about representation and what it means to him. So he does all this kind of cool outreach with young people. And I think that matters.
And I think it would, even if we don't see somebody become an astronaut or something like that, at least seeing the image of someone saying, maybe I could be good at this. I mean, we saw with Charles Murray and his research, people saying African-Americans just can't do certain things, or they're just genetically behind people. And that gets thrown out there a lot. And I don't think that there's any evidence for that. A lot of it is environment. I think if you have good role models, it encourages people.
Well, in the same way that we saw the then president of Harvard talking about perhaps not enough women were in STEM because of biological aptitude, right? That I think caused so much debate, you know, circular debate launched almost immediately when Larry Summers said that. So,
And the Google memo, too.
That yeah, came right.
out. I have a brother who works for Google, and we had about an hour-long discussion about it. And he said Google is trying to be more diverse, and the memo is kind of like a pushback at it. Someone feels like, oh, if we, you know, that means they see it as a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
If women are advancing, if non-white people are advancing, therefore my pie share is going to be smaller, and I'm going to speak out against that.
Yeah, certainly. Can't we all just get along, for crying out loud?
Exactly. Yeah. Not only that, I mean, a lot of the science the person suggested, there is no science to
right.
it.
Right. It's inaccurate and is long debunked. Science is super important. Well, thank you so much. I wish we could talk for hours more, but unfortunately we have run out of time on the program. But I really appreciate you joining us tonight, Dr. John Turris, political science professor at LaGrange College. Again, I will tweet out the Huffington Post piece that you wrote that's so fascinating about how the space race and the civil rights movement collided and informed each other quite a bit. Thank you so much for being with us tonight.
And thank you very much. I look forward to listening to the rest of the program.
Awesome. Thanks so much. All right. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. If you are an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn.